the amount of ships. So again, this combination of both the market, the logic of commercial risk on the one hand, but on the other hand, the fact that Iran poses a credible threat to ships in the Strait of Hormuz, in the Gulf of Oman, and both directly and via its allies in Ansar al-Allah in the Red Sea, means that I actually think that the crisis is only going to get kind of more horrific before it gets any better.
Lale Khalili, thanks so much for joining us. Professor of Gulf Studies at the University of Exeter and author of several books, including Extractive Capitalism, How Commodities and Cronyism Drive the Global Economy, and Sinews of War and Trade, Shipping and Capitalism in the Arabian Peninsula. When we come back, the ongoing civil war in Sudan enters its fourth year, creating what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Stay with us.
Sola voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correr es mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdida en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen clandestino por no llevar papel. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad.
¿Qué será de nosotros si no pensamos en los niños?
Downs performing Clandestino. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman. The ongoing civil war in Sudan enters its fourth year today, creating what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The country has been engulfed in civil war since April 2023, when fighting erupted between the Sudanese Armed Forces, SAF, and the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The war quickly drew in local militias as well as foreign powers. The United Arab Emirates, in particular, has been accused of aiding the RSF. The U.S. government and a U.N. fact-finding mission have accused RSF and allied fighters of committing genocide.
The death toll from 3 years of war remains unclear. The National Health Ministry says 11,000 civilians have been killed, but some estimates are as high as 400,000. Nearly 34 million people in the country need humanitarian assistance, according to the United Nations. A new report from the Norwegian Refugee Council says in the two areas hit hardest by the conflict, North Darfur and South Kordofan, millions of people get only one meal a day, if any. On Thursday, international leaders meeting in Berlin pledged $1.5 billion for humanitarian aid in Sudan. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, quote, "This nightmare must end," and called for an immediate end to hostilities. The French foreign minister spoke at the meeting.
Today, I want to speak to the people of Sudan, to the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces. I say this once again, there is an alternative to war. You must publicly commit to the path of negotiation and peace, starting by agreeing to the ceasefire proposed by the Quad. Together with its partners, France stands ready to contribute to a monitoring and verification mechanism to ensure its implementation.
That was French Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot. The International Sudan Conference in Berlin was supposed to help revive faltering negotiations to end the fighting, but the two sides fighting the war were excluded. The Sudanese foreign minister criticized Western leaders for not coordinating with Khartoum, describing the conference as a, quote, colonial tutelage approach. For more on Sudan, we're joined now by Khulood Khair, a Sudanese political analyst and head of Confluence Advisory, a think tank founded in Khartoum. She joins us today from Nairobi. Welcome back to the show, Khulood. If you could just share your reflections on these 3 years of war in Sudan, and also your response to this Berlin conference that's ongoing?
So, you know, the war in Sudan has really, you know, plunged the country and, more importantly, its civilians into just the depths of hell. We have seen that it's not just become the world's largest humanitarian crisis, as the UN points out, but also the world's largest hunger crisis, the world's largest displacement crisis, and the world's largest sexual violence crisis. But this war is, you know, not just fought on the bodies of civilians by happenstance. It's not incidental to the fighting. It is precisely the point. This war is a war of succession between the SAF and the RSF, who want to inherit the military security state of former dictator Omar al-Bashir. And they're doing so in large part, not just by fighting each other, but also by diminishing as much as possible the revolutionary fervor and the calls for civilian democratic rule in Sudan. They're doing this by effectively fighting a war against civilians, ensuring that, as the UN report today said, that 71% of the country is below the poverty line, that you have Sudan's production capacity dwindling by 90% in just 3 years. And things seem set to get worse, particularly as the agricultural season, which many will rely on to stave off the food insecurity and famine, is likely to fail as a result of growing fuel and fertilizer prices owing to the war in the Gulf. When it comes to the Berlin conference, you know, it very much set out to really focus attention on what is happening to civilians. So there was a component about the humanitarian impact of this war, alongside a pledging conference for humanitarian aid, which, as you said, raised $1.5 billion. There was a ministerial conference also to recommit from the international community some level of commitment towards a ceasefire. And most importantly for me, there was an element of it that was about getting different civilians from different walks of life, from different political backgrounds together. And this is really the thing that both the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces object to. They don't just object to not being invited, they object to the fact that civilians are being centered rather than they themselves, when they themselves have multiple platforms in which they can get global attention. What they're really afraid of here is that Sudanese civilians will come together precisely as a result of this war and create a lot of international pressure for the war to end. And so what they've been doing on the ground in real time is militarizing society in Sudan, militarizing the economy, and basically ensuring that a lot of people who want access to resources, who want access to services, and who want access to livelihoods and money, pick up a gun to do so. That what they're hoping to do is, by militarizing the context in Sudan, that any calls for civilian democratic rule are pushed to the wayside.
The United Nations World Food Program reports that close to 25 million people are suffering from acute hunger. 2 million face famine or risk of famine. How has the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran and the disruption of the Strait of Hormuz exacerbated food insecurity in the Gulf? And also talk about the role of the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, in supporting the RSF, the Rapid Support Force, the Rapid Sudan Forces.
So what we have right now is that it's April. Next month in May is generally the planting season. Then you have the rainy season from late June to late September. Thereafter, you have the harvest. And so what is needed right now in April is fuel for any kind of mechanical equipment required for farming, as well as agricultural inputs like fertilizer, seeds, and others. Right now, because of the issues around the Strait of Hormuz, but also the hit to natural gas production, which produces a lot of the byproducts, including fertilizer, what you have is in Sudan an inability to get access to those agricultural inputs. Just in the past few weeks, as the impact of the fuel shortages has hit, we have seen vast queues in Sudan for petrol as well as for diesel and other fuels. What we also have in Sudan is that the the exchange rate for the US dollar is on the black market is pegged to the price of oil. And so as the price of oil skyrockets, so too does the value of the dollar against the pound. This means that inflation is going through the roof. And so whatever food is already available has become out of reach for very many people. And because we don't see any end in sight for the tensions around the Strait of Hormuz, and actually, conversely, we see perhaps a spreading of the tensions to the Red Sea, which Sudan is a literal state of, there could also be serious issues around Sudan getting access to whatever fuel is available through the Red Sea into Port Sudan. What this means is that Sudan is effectively being choked by two different straits, and at this a very critical point in the agricultural season. We also have a political fallout from the war in the Middle East. What we saw recently was that the United States government has designated the Muslim Brotherhood of Sudan as a foreign terror organization. And this FTO designation makes a very clear link in its wording to the relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood to Iran and the IRGC in Iran. Now, the timing of this suggests that it falls very much into the broader scope of conflict that is taking place in the Gulf. And the Sudan may now be sucked much more into the conflict that's going on in the Gulf, that is not just merely between Iran on the one side and the UAE and Israel on the other side, but also that what we have here is that, you know, the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces are effectively being placed into these two camps. So the Sudanese armed forces is being placed into the camp of Iran, while the rapid support forces being placed, of course, into the camp of Israel via the UAE. And what this means is that this war in Sudan, which is very much a domestic national issue around, as I said, a war of succession for the security and military state, it's around the resources in Sudan, could increasingly become much more of a proxy war. This means that any resolution to the war can also be taken out of Sudanese hands. And this means that Sudan is going to be plunged further into a conflict that has so far, we see no sort of signs of abating.
Khulod, before we conclude, could you just say something also about the region, Sudan's neighbors? You've said that there's not a single one of Sudan's neighbors that are not in some way involved or invested in the war.
Sudan has seven neighbors, all of which it shares very porous borders with. And what we have seen is that the Western neighbors of Sudan, whether that's Libya, Chad, the Central African Republic, all three have been implicated in reporting of supply lines coming through those countries into Darfur for the RSF, originating from the UAE, according to reporting out there. What we've also seen is that recently Reuters reporting on Ethiopia having some of its bases being used by the RSF, as well as parts of South Sudan being used as a staging ground for some of the RSF attacks in the southeasterly region of Blue Nile. At the same time, we have Eritrea to the east of Sudan, which has been reported training militias close to and allied to the Sudanese armed forces, and Egypt similarly also hosting some military assets close to the Sudanese border, and at the same time bombing some of these weapon supply lines in southeastern Libya. There are also some reports that the Egyptians have used American-made F-16s also in some of the campaigns in, for example, the capital Khartoum. And so in some way or other, all of these countries are involved in either allowing space for weapons transfers or actively engage in training or military operations. You also have the fact that a lot of Sudanese are displaced to some of these countries, and there are some serious security concerns about the status of Sudanese in these countries, most notably in Egypt, where we have seen many Sudanese refugees, even those carrying UNHCR refugee cards, being detained by the Egyptian authorities, and some of whom have died in detention. This, of course, without a peep from the Sudanese armed forces allied to them in Sudan. So what you have is, you know, Sudan's people being displaced to these countries being actively engaged in some lesser or greater degree in the war. And at the same time, you have Sudan's resources coming out of Sudan almost always illegally being smuggled into these countries, whether it's Egypt or Chad or South Sudan, with a lot of Sudanese products, for example, like gum arabic, very essential for the food and pharmaceutical industry, being labeled as products of those countries. Gold, of course, has has been also smuggled through some of these countries, adding a lot of economic buffers to those countries themselves, and then being exported elsewhere. And really none of that money reaching Sudanese people who, as I've said earlier, are under very, very dire economic constraints as a result of the war. What this means is that really none of Sudan's neighbors can be counted upon to be arbiters of this conflict, or indeed champions for peace, if they are profiting from it in more ways than one.
Khulood Khair, thank you so much for joining us, a Sudanese political analyst and head of Confluence Advisory, a think tank founded in Khartoum. Coming up, Into the Woodchipper, a whistleblower's account of how the Trump administration shredded U.S. aid. Back in a minute. Down Here and Say That by Dear Hoof. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Los Angeles. We spend the rest of the hour looking at the dismantling of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. Founded in 1961, the agency funded global health programs around the world. Since 2000 alone, USAID programs saved more than 92 million lives, according to an independent analysis published by The Lancet. Early in President Trump's second term, USAID found itself in the crosshairs of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, led by billionaire Elon Musk. In the middle of the night, on February 3, 2025, Musk posted on X, quote, "We spent the weekend feeding USAID into the wood chipper. Could have gone to some great parties, did that instead."
Nicholas Enrich is a former civil servant who worked at USAID through four administrations. He served as the director of policy, programs, and planning in the Bureau of Global Health until January 2025. On March 2, 2025, he was placed on administrative leave for exposing the Trump administration's illegitimate and dangerous dismantling of the agency, as he describes it. His book details What Happened is just out. It's titled Into the Woodchipper, a whistleblower's account of how the Trump administration shredded USAID. Joining us from Washington, D.C. Nicholas Enrich, thanks so much for being with us. Can you start off by talking about your decision to become a whistleblower and then describe the range of health services, since you were involved with the health program within USAID, everything from AIDS prevention to TB prevention, and what is estimated for the number of lives lost for the sudden shredding of this agency?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Yes, there are estimates that show that up to 14 million people will die over the next 5 years alone unnecessarily due to the cuts to USAID if that's not rectified. And we're already starting to see the impacts. In fact, 750,000 people have already died, most of those children, according to conservative estimates. And we're seeing, as bad as it is that we're seeing so far, the worst, unfortunately, is yet to come, with the next generation of children who are unable to get immunizations, with children being born with HIV at high rates when just a year ago those numbers were near zero. And so I'm afraid that unless we're able to make some changes, we will unfortunately be seeing those impacts years to come.
And so, Nicholas, could you talk about what happened in the early weeks of the Trump administration, including telling us about what the Trump-appointed people at USAID, what they were doing and how much they actually knew about the agency?
Sure. The DOGE team and the Trump officials that came in truly knew nothing about the agency. I put the Trump officials into two categories, those who were cruel and those who were buffoons. And most of the DOGE team that came in fell into that second category. These were people who were uninformed, unqualified, and truly knew nothing about the agency that they had been tasked with dismantling, and ignored the warning of experts that this would put millions of lives at risk.
Then your decision to write this book, why did you feel you needed to write an entire book? You wrote that memo explaining what had happened. Tell us about the book and your decision to write it.
I wrote the book because I think that there's two critical factors that people should take away from this book. The first is that we pulled the rug out from under people around the world. We broke promises to millions who were relying on USAID services and left them hanging out to dry. We broke promises to governments and broke partnerships that will have lasting effects for years to come. As the legacy of Trump's administration in foreign policy becomes clear, I think when the dust settles, we'll see that the dismantling of USAID ends up being one of the most impactful, in a terrible way, impacts of his entire legacy. But the other reason that I wrote the book was that maybe it's too late to save USAID, but there are other agencies, other institutions in the United States that are hanging on by a thread. And at a time that more Americans are feeling that something is fundamentally broken in our democracy, I wanted to tell this story to remind readers that normal people can make important choices every day. And when people see things that they truly believe are not okay, they're being asked to do things that are illegal. And this is inside the government or in everyday life, whether you're working at a university or working at a law firm or just a neighbor who sees neighbors getting picked up on the streets by masked ICE agents. It's up to you to stand up and speak out when you see something wrong.
Speaking to reporters February of last year, President Trump called for USAID to be shut down.
It's absolutely obscene, dangerous, bad, very costly. I mean, virtually every investment made is a con job.
So can you talk, Nicholas Enrich, about the significance of this decision, whether USAID is completely shut down, and what happened to, for example, PEPFAR, which was a President George W. Bush project, which, of course, addressed the issue of AIDS, has been credited with saving some 26 million lives, enabling nearly 8 million babies to be born without HIV infection. I remember when Elon Musk said, oh, we made a little mistake, but we fixed that.
Right. The decision to dismantle USAID was made by people, as I mentioned, who really knew nothing about the agency. And we would warn them on a day-by-day basis. And I think one of the things that I wrote this book about was to expose, however bad viewers might think that from the outside that things were inside of USAID, they were far, far worse. These were people who ignored warnings that were specific to U.S. national security. For example, there was an outbreak of Ebola happening in Uganda at the time that USAID was being dismantled. And while I knew we couldn't start a robust outbreak response that we usually have because of everything that was being dismantled, there were a few key activities that I really felt that we needed to do. And they would not even let us screen passengers at airports that were traveling on international flights onwards to the United States to make sure that they had Ebola, that they did not have symptoms of Ebola. So that was a real risk to U.S. national security. And it was just sort of laughed off and ignored by the political appointees and DOGE.
Senrich, one of the things, one of a very prominent member of Trump's cabinet, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, had initially been a great enthusiast of U.S. aid, but ultimately went along with what the Trump administration overall was planning to do with U.S. aid. What do you think accounts for that change?
Yeah, Marco Rubio was one of the biggest supporters in his previous career in the Senate and beyond of USAID. So when he was announced as the Secretary of State, the staff at USAID breathed a collective sigh of relief, thinking that while there might be policy changes coming, the core programs would be saved, because Marco Rubio recognized that there was a value to Americans of providing foreign aid and international development assistance. Since then, however, I can't speak for him, but what I can say is that his comments that he's made about USAID, that the staff were insubordinate, that no one has died because of the cuts to USAID, have been complete untruths. And what we've actually seen is a dissolving of the exact programs that Marco Rubio was once a supporter of.
And Nicholas, could you talk about, you know, we just, our earlier segment was about Sudan, the fact that it's now, the war is entering its fourth year. If you could talk about what the effects have been of U.S. aid cuts in Sudan, which is facing the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
Sure. Sudan, unfortunately, is one of the most glaring examples of what happens when the world's richest man is killing the world's poorest children. There are people in Sudan, displaced people and refugees, whose only access to health care and nutrition was through USAID support and services. And so we very rapidly started hearing horrible stories about families walking all day to get to a health clinic that had the USAID logo on the side of the building, only to find it shuttered, were unable to get access to food supplements, and ended up having to go home at the end of those days and make the harrowing decision of which of their children to feed.
And finally, Nicholas, if you could talk about the fact that all of this is happening, the cuts in U.S. aid are happening at the same time as all wealthy countries have massively cut down on their overseas aid.
Right. That is a compounding problem that we're seeing a decline in foreign aid around the world that has precipitated from the cuts to USAID. And I'm afraid, again, it's not just the impacts that are happening right now. USAID and other forms of international development built partnerships and long-lasting support and allies around the world. President Obama said that for most people around the world, USAID is the United States. And I'm afraid to think about how the world looks at the U.S. after USAID is gone. And I'm afraid that our cuts, our broken promises, will actually turn countries who had once been our partners to look for support from adversaries like Russia or China, and eliminate the support that we have built over all these decades.
Nicholas Enrich, I want to thank you for being with us. New figures show Germany has for the first time surpassed the United States in overseas aid. Overseas aid from wealthy countries overall plummeting by 25%. Nicholas Enrich, former USAID official and author of the new book, Into the Woodchipper, a whistleblower's account of how the Trump administration shredded USAID. And that does it for our show. I'm here in Los Angeles for the theatrical release of the new documentary, Steal the Story, Please, directed by Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl. I'm here with Carl Diehl in Los Angeles. Tomorrow afternoon and evening, we'll be at a KPFK fundraiser at the Lemley Royal in West L.A., doing fundraisers at 1:10 and 7:10, the screening of the film followed by Q&A. Then we're headed to San Francisco with Tia Lesson, the co-director. We can't wait to see people at the Roxy and in Berkeley and San Rafael. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
this station and the more than 250 across the country like it need your support. Day in and day out, they bring you the news that matters. They play the music you won't hear anywhere else, and they are a part of this community. You can make sure they get the funding they need to grow by visiting mycri.ca, where you can find all the details about the Community Radio Initiative. It takes less than 5 minutes and a few clicks to generate an email to the politicians who need to hear from you, mycri.ca.